Today's program has been brought to you by Hearst Ranch, the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. For more information, visit HearstRanch.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Chef's Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to us on heritageradionetwork.org. And today, we have the greatest Spanish chef, I would say, working in America, but I think the greatest Spanish chef working in the world, because he is not only a chef, he's a missionary. He can excite you about anything he's excited about, but Spanish cuisine is his passion. Jose Andres was chosen in 2011 as the outstanding chef of the James Beard Foundation. That meant he was numero uno chef in the United States for 2011. In 2009, he was named one of GQ's Men of the Year. His restaurants have garnered stars and 4 stars from the LA Times for the Bazaar in LA. And last but not least, I mean, there's pages of awards that this chef has won. But in 2012, he was named by Time Magazine as one of the most influential people in the world. We're going to get into that. But first, I want to say, hola, Jose. How are you?
Very happy to be here with you, Dorothy. Very happy.
Okay, but we're going to get into your why you're the most influential person, you know, this year for Time. But first, I want to ask you, what was little Jose like? Where did you grow up in Spain? What were you like when you were 7 years old?
Well, I've been an immigrant all my life. I was born in a beautiful region called Asturias in the northern part of Spain. Very green, very rainy, mountains next to the sea at the same time. Beautiful place to grow up. But when I was 6, my mother and father moved to Barcelona. And we moved to a town 30 minutes away from Barcelona. And was great for me because it was a little town called Santa Coloma de Cervelló. And everybody in that little town were farmers. So I grew up around farms, especially cherries. That town produces some of the best cherries in the world. So I grew up in a farming town. My father, who is a nurse, my mother, who also is a nurse, they love to cook. We need to understand that cooking in Spain, you did that because you couldn't afford to go to restaurants over 30 years ago. And cooking and shopping was what everyone did. So I grew up surrounded by farmers, going with the farming seasons, going to shop with my mom and dad every other day, and cooking at home every other day. So that's what little Jose was. He was a guy that saw cooking as part of everyday life at home.
Did you like school?
Let's put it this way. I have a fascination for learning. Even probably I'm not the type of a person that learns under the systems that are in place today. So I was a okay student. A few things I love, like for example science. I love anything that had to do with science, and I will learn on my own. The teacher will not have to tell me learn. I will go always ahead of the curve. I stopped studying when I was roughly 15, but I moved to a culinary school, which is still open today, and you had to be 18th, but because it was a private school and was the first year of the school, they will take very much anybody, and I was lucky that they took me. And I went to the school. Even again, I will not be a good student, and I will be going to restaurants every day. Today, almost 25, 30 years later, I regret that I didn't have a more proper formal education, because I believe my life will be easier. But nonetheless, it's never too late. Everything I lack in education wise, I cannot give excuses for anything, for family.
I don't think you need any.
Or for economic situations. This is the message I send always to every young person that tells me, should I go to school? Like, definitely yes. And because I regret I didn't have the right frame to study. But, you know, again, never too late. So over the last 25 years, I've been taking every minute I have free in my life just to keep learning what I lack.
So. I know you're a big reader and books, and my gosh, I think life is education more than school. Are you a typical Spanish guy that loved football? Did you play a lot of football when you were growing up?
I play a lot of football, even I've never been a very, very
soccer,
good soccer.
Soccer
in America, football for the rest of the world. But what I learned is that life is short, and I play everything there is to play. I play tennis, I play ping pong, I play paddle.
Really?
Which is a fascinating new tennis-like game. I play basketball, I play soccer, I play football, I scuba dive, I kite surf now, I play chess. I'm not very good
at boundaries.
Not very good at anything, but I try to be. Even lately I'm learning lacrosse because my daughters now are learning. So I think life is short not to get a glimpse of everything there is to know.
Absolutely. So after school, how was your journey to actually coming to America and becoming the chef you are? What was your journey?
So I was very lucky because very early on, through my process in the school, since I was 15th, I was able to work in Barcelona with some of the best chefs. One of them, Jean-Louis Nechel. He was the best chef in the 80s and 90s in Spain. He still is one of the great. He was a two-star Michelin. He came under the wing of one of the great French chefs, Alain Chapelle. And when he moved to Spain and he moved to Catalonia, he became instantly the best chef. So I worked with him in his restaurant in Barcelona. I worked in another restaurant called Reno, which was the most traditional, elegant Catalan restaurant in Barcelona at the time. In the summers, I would work under a new young chef called Ferran Adrià, who had a restaurant called El Bulli that no one knew, and where most of the time the restaurant was empty over 23, 24 years ago. So my journey was surrounded by these amazing chefs that I spent time with them that become unbelievably important in my life.
Okay, we just have to take a little stop out at Il Bulli because it became so famous. But what was it, A, how did you know about it, and B, why did you go there, and what was it like? And just spend, a small amount of time on that.
Destiny, I never fight destiny. I think life has always a plan for every one of us, and sometimes we try to fight that plan. And me, I'm a guy that just goes with a plan that life has already in place for me. So my first summer, I was 15th going to 16th, I went to a little town called Rosas. Rosas is a beautiful town, a fishing village north of Barcelona, very close to France. And I went to work there in a fish place that was the best fish place in that part of Spain. One day, this chef, young guy called Ferran Adrià, came to my restaurant to have gambas al ajillo, or what we call is garlic shrimp, a very traditional tapa. Well, in Rosas is where El Bulli is. And I say it's destiny because the next summer I came back to work at El Bulli and to work with Ferran. Again, a chef that no one really knew. Everyone began talking about him, but he was very young. He was barely 23, 24.
Was he doing traditional food at that time?
At that time, and we're talking over 23, 24 years ago, already he was very cutting edge. Even he began, like everything else in life has a beginning, traditional Catalan cooking that he was modernizing. He was making the sauces lighter and the cooking time shorter, but maintaining the qualities of what the traditional Catalan cooking was. But obviously, by at that time, he was already kind of slowly moving forward. He would look to France for inspiration. We would go some weekends to France to eat and come back over Sunday, Monday. We would go to Paul Bocuse, or we would go to try to go Michel Gerard, and going and coming back. And so a lot of the inspiration we were getting at the time was from France. But one day he said, no more looking to France, no more looking anywhere else. We have to be now within our own world, and we need to rediscover who we are. And if we keep looking outside, we are only going to be bringing influences from the outside. Now with what we know, let's see how we recreate our own style. And that's what Ferran did.
So, you were in the Navy. You were a sailor. Yeah. What stage in your life did that take?
Well, you have to, back in time, you had to be in the military for 6 months to a year. And I was looking forward to being in the military. A lot of people complain because, you know, back in the days, they don't pay you. They only give you the room and the food, that's it, and the trip to get to your destination. But me, I was looking forward. So I got in the Navy, and happens they sent me to the south of Spain. I was 18 going to 19. And for me, it was great, but I wanted to be in a ship, and I knew where I wanted to go. I wanted to go to a tall ship called Juan Sebastián del Cano, which is where they train the midshipmen, the officers to be. And it's one of the most beautiful ships in the world. But guess what? The Navy had plans for me. They want me to be the cook of the Admiral of Spain.
The Admiral?
And I was like, no way. I want to go in a ship.
So the Admiral wasn't on a ship. He was on land.
He was the big boss who is not in a ship. And I'm like, no kidding. So anyway, but in life, when you are persistent and you have a very clear north of where you want to go, you know, the first option I had, I told the Admiral himself, sir, I love to serve you and cook for you, but my destiny is not here with you, but my destiny is serving you and Spain in a ship. And he listened to my message and he put me in a ship. And it's when I came to America first time as a sailor of the Spanish Navy.
So you were Spanish, that's how you came to America, on a ship. And where did you come to New York?
Or? Well, we went around the world. We went Africa, South America, the Caribbean, and then we came to Pensacola, beautiful Pensacola.
In the Gulf of Mexico.
In the Gulf of Mexico, beautiful Florida, the town of the Five Flags. And then we came all the way to Norfolk, Virginia, and then New York. And I spent 7 days in New York, and, you know, I barely went back to the ship. I was fascinated walking in the streets of Manhattan. And I knew that when we came back to Spain, I knew that I had to find a way to come back to the States.
So how did you do that?
Well, right before Barcelona 92, the Olympic Games, was many companies in Spain, and especially in Catalonia, that they saw an opportunity to come to China and to come to America and to come anywhere. Barcelona 92 was a great way to expand horizons. So restaurants were no any different, and were few small Spanish companies that they were thinking about opening in New York. Was three restaurants that opened in the 90s, 91, 92. And was a restaurant called El Dorado Petit that opened here in New York. And I got a visa. They used to give the E2 visas. And I got a visa to come to work here for 6 months. And quite frankly, I was happy with 6 months. I was not planning to stay any longer. But here I came, and these opportunities keep showing up. And 22, 23 years later almost.
So here you were here for 22. 6 months, and at the end of the 6 months, did you go back to Spain?
No, I stay. I began doing things for Disney. I began doing things for Westin Hotels. I began...
For Disney, how did you do that?
Well, because I guess there was not many Spanish chefs, and when I opened the restaurant here, when you open in New York...
Everybody knows,
and I was young, but everyone was interested in Spanish cooking, and always was an opportunity to do things. So here I stay, and opportunities kept showing up, and I kept just following the flow of life.
Okay, well, we're going to take a break here, and we're going to come back and hear about your restaurants.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef. Pasture raised on 150,000 acres in Central California. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, free-range, sustainably produced, humane. Hearst Ranch grass-fed beef, the authentic flavor of the American West.
Welcome back. This is Chef Story with Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today my guest is none other than Chef Jose Andres, the famous chef, Time Magazine Most Influential Person, 2011 Outstanding Chef of the James Beard Foundation. And we've just sort of hopped the pond here, and you've come from Spain to the United States. And how did you start, opening your restaurants? You've had so many, and you have 14 now. What was the first? How did you get your first, and why 14?
Well, I'm in New York. It's... 1992 is September, October. The restaurant I was working, I had a need to leave because it was not working right. The owners were not taking care of the restaurant as they should. I knew I had to do something. So I was looking, and I got the opportunity to go to Japan. I was having the opportunity to go to Chicago to work with the great Richard Melman. I got these opportunities, but I had to make a decision. But before I left Manhattan, I went to work for 3 weeks with Barry Wine at the Guilty Giraffe, that many people don't know, but the Guilty Giraffe was like the restaurant in New York at the time. Very small, in the Sony building. Barry Wine was doing all these Japanese meets America, all the sophistication of Japan, but Matsutake mushrooms and other things. So it was very lucky I saw one of the great chefs at its prime before he closed and he moved to other things. So anyway, I was trying to decide what's next for me. And I got this phone call from these people in Washington, my partner Rob Wilder, and friend, and Roberto Alvarez, a Dominican. And I was in La Jolla at the time, because again, I was looking for what's next.
In California?
In California. I had these families that they kind of took me under their wing, because I used to go to California to cook, to raise money for cancer research. And I met all these beautiful people in La Jolla, so they were taking care of me like if I was their son. So again, I was thinking about what's next. I get the phone call, Washington. I moved to Washington.
How did they know you? I mean, how did you know Rob Wilder?
Well, because they knew my restaurant here in New York where I work. They knew that all those cooks and sous chefs and chefs left the restaurant, and they were looking where they went. They were looking for people like me because they knew they wanted to open a Spanish restaurant.
Oh.
And they needed cooks, sous chefs, and chefs. And they needed someone. They found me. through friends. I'm a guy that loves to talk because I know when you meet people, it's always opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that's life. And they found me. I came. I met them. I liked them. And by March 1993, I moved to Washington. And I never looked back. We opened Haleo around April 1993. I was the head chef. My executive chef was a great woman. It's always a great woman in my life, Ann Cashin, who still is one of the is a great person, a great chef. She still has restaurants in Washington D.C. and she does many other things. And I was maybe not ready to be head chef. I was 23. 23. But I learned a lot from her. I was a great cook, excellent cook, which is not the same as being an excellent chef or excellent organizer, especially when you're so young. But anyway, it was great having her next to me and many other people, my partners, and just one day at a time. We opened Haleo and then everything else.
What was the menu like happening when you first, at 23?
Well, is the menu, every restaurant, I always believe, is a living creature. Restaurants are not, are things that has feelings. And the feelings are, you have to listen to the walls, to the food, to the ingredients, to the wine, to the guests and the workers and the co-workers. And the menu was what I believe was a Spanish, what the Spanish cooking was supposed to be. Everyone was telling me that small portions or tapas were the way to go, but everyone wanted me to do big portions. So they wanted to call it tapas, but they want bigger portions. And I was like, no. This is not the way. If we're going to call it tapas, it's going to be small. If we call it tapas, we're going to make sure that people have many, and they're going to do a big celebration every time they come to the restaurant. And everyone told me, if you don't do big portions, you're not going to be successful in the meat and potatoes kind of Washington, D.C. of 1993.
That's true. Wow.
But I had feeling that that was not the way. I love meat and potatoes, but it's boring if you do it every day. Tapas, sharing, small dishes, testing 5-10 different things in one meal is more fun. It's like the rainbow full of colors. Mm-hmm. So it was very simple. White and black, kind of gray, which to me is the meat and potatoes type of restaurant, or the rainbow, which tapas is all about, and the Spanish cooking and the Spanish way of living is all about. And, you know, we were very blessed because we were successful from day one, and we opened in a very bad neighborhood. One of my first guests was Senator Patrick Moynihan.
Really?
one of the most legendary, beloved senators, even being a Democrat, even beloved by many Republicans. So it's no many types like that sometimes in Washington. And he was one of my first guests. And he told me one day, Jose, if you work hard, America will always give you opportunity. America will always love you back. So we're very happy you're here with us.
I follow
that to heart. And here we are. Almost 20 years later. We are about to celebrate 20-year anniversary of Haleo, Spanish restaurant.
Your Spanish restaurant. So now, 14 restaurants later,
yep.
You have the Bazaar in L.A., which is the
and
hottest.
And Miami.
But it's the hottest restaurant in L.A., I can attest to that. 4 stars in the New York, L.A. Times. Yeah. Excuse me, L.A. Times. What was that like, getting 4 stars from the L.A. Times? Oof. And being outstanding James Beard chef and having all those accolades? Yeah. What was that year like?
The critic at the L.A. Times, Irene Birbila, gave us 4 stars. I will thank her forever. Even that's a blessing, but also it's kind of a curse. Once you get 4 stars, it's very hard to, because you can only go down. I believe we got 4 stars because we were able to serve a very high quality of food in a very fun, festive environment, and doing it at a very, very high level. Kind of funny, I had already 3-4 successful restaurants in Washington, already kind of being James Beard Award winner, all those things. But all of a sudden, 4 stars kind of put you in the map. This happened the Wednesday before the Oscars. And when the Oscars are happening, everybody around the world is in LA. So all of a sudden, we were not only news in LA, we were news all around across America, but we were news all across the world. Kind of the news where the first Oscar has been given to Chef, because getting 4 stars doesn't happen every day. Again, this is humble because it means, and that's the conversation I have with my team. Guys, we cannot believe we are worth 4 stars. But nonetheless, now we have to work even harder to deserve every one of those stars. And that's what we've done ever since, and that's what we do. We don't work in what we got yesterday, we work to deserve what we would maybe get in tomorrow. You have to wake up every day, use working hard to deserve sometimes the praise you get, because again, anything in cooking especially, everything you do today is forgotten.
Every day you have to earn your money. You know, you've been chosen as one of Time's most influential people. And if you read the article, it was spectacular. Tony Bourdain wrote it, and it was about him being in Haiti and really, you know, no air conditioning. This is after the earthquake. Feeling sorry for himself that he's kind of camping out in a hotel room. And late at night, he goes down to the bar, and he hears a familiar laugh, and it's you in the bar. What were you doing in Haiti? And it was incredibly impressive for Time magazine to choose you as one of the most influential people.
Well, I was very very happy by being included. Not so much for me to be in Time, but the meaning for the culinary profession. I believe food is an important issue. Food is beyond sharing a great bottle of champagne or a great dish with friends in a fancy restaurant. Food is so much more powerful than that, and I think to be honored by Time sends precisely that message. I do believe that my profession, and I don't mean only chefs, but everybody that makes that is part of the profession of feeding people, which takes farmers and takes sommeliers and takes food critics and takes cooking school owners and takes so many people. I believe we have to take care of feeding everybody, feeding the world, creating jobs, making sure that America is healthy and is not obese, making sure that America and the world is not hungry. And this takes a lot of courage and a lot of people. And one person alone cannot make it happen. Everyone is going to have to contribute. But what I know is that I may be feeding the few, but I think it's our responsibility to make sure that we are feeding also the many.
So what are you doing specifically in Haiti?
In Haiti, I went right after the earthquake. I've been there more than 8-9 times by now. I've been spending a lot of my free time there with permission of my wife and my kids. And what I've been doing is learning. I don't like to take any praise for what I'm doing yet, because I believe in order to help, you have to learn to know how you can help. So what I've been doing is spending a lot of time in the mountains, sometimes sleeping under the stars, and I create organization with $50,000 my wife and I got from a foundation, an award I received, the Bilsek Prize for the Arts. So I didn't put the money in my pocket. I created Wall Central Kitchen. And Wall Central Kitchen is simple. I'm trying to change the life of people through the power of food. That's the big idea. How I'm doing this? Okay. We are building a canteen in a place called Fomberret, very near the frontier with Dominican Republic. And that canteen is going to be feeding 100 kids in the middle of nowhere. How I'm going to be feeding the kids? A, using sustainable cookstoves, so people stop using charcoal. B, building a little chicken farm that the chickens can produce eggs and can produce money by selling the chickens in the near markets. So these can generate income, so we can keep buying food for the kids, and we can pay the woman, sometimes the mothers, that are spending time feeding the kids. So this is one project. We may be investing in a strawberry farm They have the strawberries, but they don't have the mechanism to bring them to Port-au-Prince. So the strawberries in Port-au-Prince are from America or from France, which is okay. But it's not very sad that these women are producing beautiful strawberries, but because they don't have
the transportation or distribution
or the phone or the marketing or the accounting, they don't sell them. So it's very great ways to invest in people to make them successful on their own. So World Central Kitchen is going to be there to find ways
to help
people through the power of food. And I have different things. Like we have a bakery in an orphanage that this is supposed to be up and running, hopefully.
All of this for $50,000?
Well, we are now raising more money.
You're raising more money.
But again, I'm a brand new... You're going to hear more about World Central Kitchen. We will need a lot of volunteers. We will need a lot of cash. But the cash I'm going to be asking people to donate is not going to be a donation. It's going to be an investment. And when you start thinking as an NGO that the new way is not donating anything anymore, but investing in the well-being of people, I think the world will be better. And that's what World Central Kitchen is going to be doing in Haiti and hopefully in many other countries around the world.
How did you... You know, I know that you're in Washington, D.C., that gives you a lot of access to the American government. But it seems like you're in the White House, you're in the State Department. How did you hook up with all those people?
Well, when you are in Washington, that's what you do. Again, I always follow the flow of life. And life takes me to fascinating places. And I always have fascinating opportunities to help. So that's what I do.
Did they walk in your restaurant and then you said, oh, I'm happy to help out? And then they just come in and say, hey, would you come and cook for us?
Or they come in the restaurant or I knock in the door. Where there I see opportunity, why not? We can keep talking about that after.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to take a break here. And in a minute, we're going to come back and continue with Chef Jose Andres. Welcome back. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and you're listening to Chef Story. And today we're coming to you from the International Culinary Center, where I am interviewing our brand new Dean of Spanish Studies, Chef Jose Andres. We just kicked off the inaugural luncheon for our new Spanish Studies program. And I wanted to ask Jose, I think he's traded his hat or his toque from being a chef to being an absolute missionary about the products of Spain. So let's delve into that a little bit. You've got 14 restaurants. You're working in Haiti. Why now a Spanish school?
Well, let me put it this way. I already probably have enough projects for the next 30, 40 years of my life.
I'll say.
So the great thing is that I don't have to think about any new projects. Mm-hmm. I have a great restaurant. I have a Mexican restaurant. I have a Chinese restaurant. I have different restaurants because it's a great way for me and my team to learn. And I believe also I have something to bring to the table. Why? Because I know about those cookings. I've been traveling through China, through Greece, through Turkey, through Mexico. So restaurants for me, like if I was a book writer, are my way to express what I know about those countries, are a way for me to tell a story. At the end, a chef is a storyteller through the power of the food and the dishes the chef cooks. So now all this is done. I have my non-profits in Washington that I'm the chairman emeritus of DC Central Kitchen, an amazing organization that we teach people how to cook. We clean them, we take them from the street, and then we put them after training working in local restaurants. Fascinating program. Now we have World Central Kitchen where I'm doing the same, trying to do the same in Haiti and other parts around the world. Wow, I'm covered. I even have my American restaurant. That's my little contribution to a country that has given me so much. So we open America Eats, the history of America through a restaurant. All this is happening. I'm very happy. I'm very honored. But then is the next level. Spain is really at my heart because I don't have to think hard about Spain. It's who I am, it's where I come from, it's what I know, it's what is in my blood. I did a TV show, Made in Spain, that I was taking America and people around the world, because the show is in more than 30 countries now, telling the world what Spain is. Traveling through Spain, but also cooking at my home, where it could be anywhere in the world. So that's done. But what's next? Well, I have now 4 or 5 Spanish restaurants. And I see that the restaurant is not sometimes the place to educate. And yes, I'm an educator, I'm a teacher. Everyone at my restaurants, when I get people, I have to train them. But I see the need of getting people that they have a higher level of training on knowing the Spanish history, on knowing the Spanish, of knowing the Spanish ingredients, of knowing the Spanish techniques. I think still everyone thinks they know Spanish, but no one really knows Spanish cooking. So it's a great opportunity to open the door to thousands, to hopefully hundreds of thousands of people, of Americans, of young Americans, that they want to have a new thing to do in life. So here, partnering with you, partnering with this great school, let's use the power of education to create a bridge between Spain and America, and eventually between Spain, America, and from America to the world, to start writing a new chapter on what Spanish cooking is. And we have to do this now by the avant-garde, which is important, that people eventually will know it, what some people unfortunately call molecular, but to start teaching about what the basics of Spanish cooking are, what an alioli sauce is, what a romesco sauce is, what is the history of Spanish cooking, what Greece and the Romans has to do with Spain, what the Arabs and the Jewish have to do with Spain. So if we start telling people that, they will have a very amazing understanding of what Spanish cooking is all about.
How is Spanish cooking different from French or Italian? I mean, and I'm talking Southern French. You all use tomatoes, you know, you all use garlic, you all have the same kind of ingredients. What would you say is the differentiating point of Spanish cuisine?
Obviously, Spain is at the heart of what we understand as Mediterranean, but it's so fascinating, right? You can have one ingredient, something like tomato, and in Spain, France, and Italy, that tomato can be treated in so many different ways. And this is what is fascinating about our profession, that only one ingredient can be hundreds of dishes in different parts of the world. When you put two ingredients, then it's thousands of dishes. And if you put three, then it's hundreds of thousands. So the formula used grows exponentially. Mm. So tomato in Spain, tomato in Italy can be this amazing spaghetti pomodoro. Mm-hmm. In France can be an amazing ratatouille if you will use tomato in that particular recipe. In Spain can be a fascinating gazpacho. Gazpacho, which is this fascinating soup that more than a soup, conceptually, is a salad in a bowl. Wow. So one humble tomato that actually doesn't even belong to Europe, that came from Mexico, that came from America back in the 15th century, arrives to Spain, then arrives to the rest of Europe, and then to the rest of the world, and becomes different things. The difference between Spain and Italy and France is that it's not any different. It just happens that Italian cooking is Italian, France is French, and Spanish is Spanish. At the end, everyone has its own characteristics. In Spain, we love more olive oil. But the truth is that we love olive oil more in the southern part of Spain. In the northern part of Spain, we use more butter or fats. Even things are changing. So the fascinating thing is that I cannot tell you what the differences are. It's only for everyone to understand that the Spanish cooking is very distinctive and the recipes are very different from anything else we know about European cooking.
So what are you hoping that young Americans will learn about Spanish cooking?
What I think they will learn about the Spanish cooking is that today we are, when we go to a supermarket, we get hundreds of ingredients and different herbs and different salts and different oils. And sometimes, because we have the option and the access to so many ingredients, it seems it's that unbelievable need of putting as many ingredients as we can in one plate, because seems that that shows you how powerful you are, because you have the power to buy and you have the knowledge to use them. And so if we can put 20 ingredients in a plate, you're going to be so much better. I do believe one of the things the Spanish cooking is going to be bringing to the table is that a humble garlic, a humble olive oil, and a simple tomato can create a simple dish. That sometimes, if you make a traditional paella, the most iconic rice dish in the world, with permission to risotto, with permission of Italian risotto, that if you make a humble paella, a good stock out of the fish heads, and a simple sofrito, that simple tomato sauce, sometimes with addition of green pepper, sometimes with addition of garlic, can create a unique dish. So here we are going to be learning that in Spanish cooking, usually less is more. That, I think, will be the most amazing contribution of Spanish cooking to America and to the new students, hopefully, that will join me in this crusade of bringing Spanish cooking not only to America, but to many other countries around the world.
How much of Spanish cooking today, I know a lot of people think it's all this modern avant-garde cooking. Where does that place in your course? Is that Spanish cooking?
Of sure it's Spanish cooking. Well, what many people know as molecular cooking is what we call in Spain avant-garde. And I do believe that Spain was very lucky because Spain is next to France. We only have the Pyrenees as what separates us from the French. And by the proximity of Spain to France, we were lucky because we had all this influence so near us. So everything happened really in Spain, initially in Catalonia and in the Basque Country. And it's a reason why. Both regions are next to France, and they always historically they had very easy access to France. So the big revolutions in Spanish cooking really happened in those two amazing regions, and that's why they are the most powerful culinary regions in Spain, with permission of every other region. So being next to France gave us this amazing potential of taking with everything that happened with Nouvelle Cuisine in France, with all the influence of obviously the Fernand Poins very early on, but then the Paul Bocuse, the Michel Gerards, blah blah blah, then with ending with the Ducasse and the Robuchons, and wow, it's one moment that when France becomes such a big powerful influence, all the good things ended in Spain. Many other countries, but Spain is the one that probably received the best. And then we began having great minds like Arzak, the legendary Spanish Basque chef, with all his friends surrounding him. Then all the Catalan cooking way before Ferran Adrià that happened around Barcelona, that was many chefs that are not unknown, but that they become very, very powerful in the 60s, 70s. Then Ferran Adrià shows up. Was natural that Ferran Adrià was going to be showing up. He was already being influenced by so many people in France and then in Spain. So avant-garde cooking in Spain happened only because we had a very powerful traditional cooking and because the proximity to France. So what I will tell everybody is, in our course you will learn avant-garde Spanish cooking. You will learn the cooking that Spain is known for today. But before students get to the point, we're going to make sure that they learn the basics, because without the basics, you will not be a successful avant-garde cook ever. If you want to be modern, that's awesome. But before you learn modern, you need to understand the basics. And the basics is everything. It's what we call traditional cooking, but I don't believe it's even traditional. Many of the things, even in France, in Italy, that are called traditional, are unbelievably modern. So again, You need to learn the basics. You need to learn the traditions. You need to learn the history. And then when you are prepared at the level, then you can be taking on esferifications on earth and on foams.
Actually, this course is so imbued, not just in the cooking, but in the culture of Spain, that if you don't speak Spanish, there'll be total immersion Spanish language for you, because you're going to wind up in Spain. You can't do this course without going to Spain and tasting the products. And so it's about language, it's about culture, it's about putting food in its context and authenticity. So we're getting ready to close the interview, unfortunately, but I know you have three beautiful daughters. Do you want them to be chefs?
Well, Carlota, Inés, and Lucia, and obviously my wife, Patricia. I'm sure I want them to be chefs. They all have more than one chef jacket. And recently they were with me at the White House. We were invited by Mrs. Obama and the White House to cook at the G8. And while the boys, they were at the Camp David.
The boys, meaning the presidents, the G8s?
I was honored to cook for the first ladies of the G8. And my daughters came with all my team, and we cook historical American menu. And I was very honored. And so I always bring my daughters to events like that. That hopefully will influence them one day to cook, or at the very least, for them to understand the power of food to change the world. So, yes, I hope they will be cooks. But if they are not cooks, I know that they will always take food with them anywhere they go.
I saw, and I was down at the State Department last week and saw you honored by the State Department to be a culinary ambassador. What does that mean? I mean, you are here as a missionary in the school trying to bring Spanish cuisine. But as you just said, you were invited by Michelle Obama to cook American food in the White House. Are you the ultimate American immigrant?
Well, I don't know if I'm the ultimate American immigrant. I know I'm very lucky that America gave me the opportunity to join America. Let's put it this way. But when I go to Haiti and I'm representing the State Department and Mrs. Clinton, because I am the ambassador of the Alliance of Clean Cookstoves, that, I don't see that as an honor. I see that as a responsibility. People probably will say, but Jose, why do you do so many things? I believe life is about synergies. Only we need to be teaching people, especially the young people, especially hopefully we'll do this in the school, that if you only take some time to think about anything, you will see that everything you do in life can have many ramifications, that you can be influencing many other people and helping many other people. Synergy probably is key. So hopefully we will teach people here through the course, at the same time they learn Spanish cooking, how synergies can make everyone better, but more important, can make everybody surrounding you better. So synergy will be key for the future of humankind. Hopefully food and synergy can really be, I believe, can change the world. Only we need to learn how to do it.
You may have thought that Jose Andres was just, not just a chef, but a chef. But I think you'll agree he's also equal part missionary. Thanks, Jose, for being with us today.
Thank you, Dorothy. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye. And see you next time. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, Chef's Story. And I want to thank our producers, Jack Inslee and Joe Sevier and Heidi Tickle. Thanks a lot, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.